Thanks for downloading this Guardian podcast, brought to you in association with Squarespace. For all you need to build beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com.
The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. As Westminster returns to business, its political relaunches and New Year's resolutions, Jeremy Corbyn plans to tap into the new mood of political populism.
I would like to be some kind of high earnings cap.
While Theresa May calls for a shared society.
An approach with fairness and solidarity at its heart.
But are there big ideas behind the soundbites, or will it all be forgotten come February? Meanwhile, power sharing in the Northern Ireland Assembly is in crisis after Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness resigns as Deputy First Minister. And why does Britain rank so low in the parliamentary representation of women? We'll hear from Tory MP Maria Miller.
The key recommendation in our report is that if there isn't more progress at the next election, that we should put a piece of legislation in place which says that 45% of candidates should be women.
But first, joining me in the studio now are The Guardian's political commentator and leader writer Anne Perkins, the deputy director of the Res Publica think tank Max Wind-Cowie, and down the line, our columnist John Harris. Welcome to you all. Well, let's start first with the Prime Minister, who began the political year with a new phrase, the shared society. Max, what does it mean? Who's her target market? And where does it fit into her overall vision of politics, do you think?
That's a lot of very big questions. I mean, I think that what's interesting is that Theresa May, it's not so much relaunch sort of a season for her. I think she's being a good Burkean Conservative, and it's about the next iteration of actually what she's been talking about for much of the last 6 months. And that is a sort of marked change of pace and tone from Cameroon modernisation. She is very clear that she thinks that the state has a good and positive and proactive role to play. She's not going to leave things either in the economic or the social sphere to sort of the vagaries of the market, be that in terms of a sort of big society, the charity sector will step in approach, or in economic terms, in terms of, you know, the market will sort it out on its own. And I think that that's the fundamental basis of it. It's sort of, at the risk of sounding far too think tanky for my own good, a sort of post-liberal critique, which says actually, in both the economic and the social spheres, people feel very unprotected, they feel very isolated, they feel very let down and very abandoned. And actually, of all the institutions available to us to help people to feel less like that, Conservatives might want to get on board with the idea that the state isn't the big bad wolf after all. And I think that's what she's getting towards. Whether or not that was all captured in the speech this week, I think it's a bit much to ask after 6 months that you get all of that down in one address. But I think that that's where she's heading. And I think that makes for very interesting times in terms of politics.
She wants to smash the neoliberal consensus as the Corbynist.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. She's Paul Mason's Conservative.
But part of it's going to be about putting sort of policy flesh on the bones, isn't it? I mean, she talks about mental health in particular this week. But it wasn't clear it was a radically different approach to that of David Cameron, who also talked about this issue quite recently. How can she show that she really means it and it's not just a kind of think tanky essay that she's written?
Well, I mean, the first of all, one should never deride think tanky essays.
No, very true.
They're an important part of our political life. I mean, I think it is important that more policy is added and more flesh put on the bones. And I think that what's quite interesting about all of this is that I think there's a tendency amongst kind of political commentariat, of which I sort of vaguely include myself, to look at Brexit and think that this is Theresa May's Vietnam. It's been thrust upon her. It's going to define her. And every kind of social policy speech or economic policy speech that she gives is sort of just an attempt to recapture some momentum that she'll never really... None of that, I think, is fair or true. I mean, I think that although Theresa May spent much of the campaign as a sort of reluctant Remainer, actually, in terms of how she's come to see and how her closest advisers and aides have come to see their job and their task in government, that actually they see the Brexit vote as being a vindication of their critique of Cameroon kind of modernisation. And they also see it as a justification for a much more decisive, dynamic and active kind of state. And that obviously there will be, and it will require much more into the terms of policy. We've got the Green Paper on Industrial Strategy coming up, which I think we have to pay close attention to see how serious the government's going to be about living up to that promise. But nonetheless, when she started talking yesterday about mental health, I thought it was an interesting way into her explaining her critique again of Cameroon modernisation. And her critique really is this: David Cameron was obsessed with sort of focusing in on bottom 1% here, or the most disadvantaged here, or And he did that for two reasons, I think. One, because he genuinely thought that was very important and was a principled, honourable man, etc. But also because it gave him a sort of carapace of modernisation, which meant that he didn't have to actually invest that much effort or time or energy in thinking about economic injustice, for example. And I think that was the most interesting part of Theresa May's speech yesterday was her kind of resolute stepping away from that and saying, actually, if you're going to make an economic system that is just for people, a political system that's just for people, public services that are just for people, including things like mental health, which is particularly relevant to a big old group of people who are stuck in the middle. And I think that's really interesting. She's, you know, at the risk of sounding unpopular and incredibly old-fashioned, she's talking about squeeze middle. And that's quite interesting.
And what about her cabinet? Because many members of, or her party more broadly, I suppose, but many cabinet members are, you know, sort of, were also part of Cameron's cabinet and ostensibly signed up to this modernising project that Max has just been, you know, kind of deriding or picking apart. Can she carry the Tories with her?
Including herself, of course.
Including herself, indeed.
Which is always something one has to kind of slightly hold on to. Mm. She was a very senior minister for 6 years. But actually, having started off being a bit sour about her, I'd like to cut her some slack. I think she's had to take over the controls as the plane flies the Atlantic. She's got, at very least, a kind of not entirely supportive crew. She's got a bust engine that she's got to try to fix without losing height. And it's a really hard job. And the other thing that I kind of can't help admiring about her, I'm not sure it's going to work for her, but, you know, she's seen this for a long time. And she's... There's something really kind of, there's a terrific continuity about May, and she believes that it's not all about the economy. And she hasn't yet found a way of saying it. I thought it was most extraordinary to start her speech yesterday with a repeat of the very successful riff on Downing Street. You can't do that 6 months on. And I think it was also extraordinary that her speech didn't even begin to reflect the impact of austerity, and most particularly the impact of austerity on the NHS. But having said that, I still want to believe that she's trying to tackle this huge problem of how you live in a globalised world without excluding a big and important sector of your population. Mm.
John, you spend a lot of your time way outside Westminster going around listening to some of those voices. Is she tapping in? Do you think she's certainly trying to tap into the discontent of people a long way away from Westminster who feel they're not very well served by what happens in London?
She's obviously aware of it, but... the thing that strikes me the most on an occasion like this, really, is the huge disjunction between a kind of stereotypical Westminster event, a speech which is on the face of it, as Max said, is quite sort of intellectually interesting. The spectacle of the Conservative Party belatedly sort of turning the page on Thatcherism and the small state, potentially, I suppose. The disjunction between that and the practical politics of all of this, as Anne has said. Chiefly, I guess, because of the question of austerity. We know that austerity in terms of local public services, which is biting so hard and ruining so many lives, is going to go on and on. So to stand there and talk about the sharing society just risks looking absurd. It's very difficult on those occasions when a politician is floating a new set of ideas, when one's watching it, to stop feeling jaded. I mean, John Major had the classless society, David Cameron had the big society, and now we've got this. And it so bumps up against reality, A, in terms of austerity, B, the challenges of Brexit, and C, something none of the main parties are facing up to. It's very difficult for them to do so, which is this extremely complicated, onerous, vexing set of circumstances bound up with how quickly the economy is changing and how much it threatens to make millions of lives even more insecure than they are already. We're living in very, very convulsive times, and so far I haven't heard anything approaching a convincing answer to any of that.
Now, I have to report that Max actually rolled his eyes at some point. At one point, I can't remember quite what point, but Max, what's your response to that?
I was eye-rolling.
Can I just make clear, I was eye-rolling a bit.
Oh, good, everyone was eye-rolling. Excellent.
Obviously not rolling my eyes. John's absolutely correct. No, I think there's something just very interesting what Anne was saying about Theresa May understanding that it's not all about money. And that's why I think that the challenges of Brexit, as it were, I mean, there are challenges, of course there are, and nobody understands that better than Theresa May, who was an on-balance politician during the referendum campaign, unlike most of our political elite, actually, and more like, I think, the majority of the British public, is sort of on-balance this way rather than ideologically committed to it. But there are also immense opportunities, and there are the opportunities that come out of Brexit for a government that is willing to be ambitious about how the state acts in our economy, to try to preempt and try to fix some of the looming crises that John's referring to there around the potential for millions more people to be disenfranchised from our economy. I think that the opportunities that come from Brexit are quite exciting. And I think that Theresa May and her close advisors understand that.
Go on, can you tell us then, please, which ones are exciting?
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn, we're going to come on to talk about it, but Jeremy Corbyn is talking about some of those exciting possibilities today, actually. I mean, the opportunity for government, and in particular, actually, for local government and devolved government outside of Westminster to get round what were quite stringent state aid rules in order to try to ensure that we A, protect industries that we have, B, provide incentives to industry to come and to develop in this country and in parts of this country where productivity are extraordinarily low, and that's having a knock-on detrimental effect for people's living standards in the most grotesque ways. Those are opportunities that come from Brexit. They're opportunities that we wouldn't have had before, and they're opportunities that we will have now. And I think that what is potentially interesting about Theresa May's approach to this, and of course so much depends on whether or not she's able to maintain any sort of political alliance within the Conservative Party, but is that she is a Conservative politician who has understood, I think, that this is a moment for a real reset in the Conservative Party's relationship to economics. And that's really exciting.
And that brings us quite neatly onto Jeremy Corbyn, I think, who has sort of returned to the fray for this week for what we warned will be an unapologetic, unvarnished left-wing populism, a sort of left-wing Trump, we're told, but like Theresa May, will involve taking on vested interests. He's putting on the table a maximum wage, and he says he's not wedded to free movement in principle. John, are these things that will go down well in Nuneaton or Sleaford or anywhere else you've spent time?
Again, we're on the level here of political spectacle. And the relatively small numbers of people who watch Andrew Marr on a Sunday or listen to the Today programme avidly on a Tuesday morning. And there's not many of those people. Corbyn, because he's not really been on the pitch politically for months, wasn't prior to that second leadership election, I don't think he's got anyone's ear. A lot of the people that I meet talking to them about politics don't really have any idea who he is. I mean, we'd like to think people are all jumping up and down saying he's too left-wing. Most people are sort of indifferent or sort of ignorant about who Jeremy Corbyn is and what he stands for. So I think it may be too late. I'm really cheering Labour people up here. I think the other thing is that this is very thin, superficial stuff. It's a sort of change of tone. They floated a few shifts of position on the EU and free movement. But as far as I could tell, being one of the 500 people who are avid listeners to the Today programme on a Tuesday morning, he didn't really know what that entailed and what it meant. The whole policy sort of, you know, became untangled inside about 30 seconds. So the whole thing doesn't feel terribly successful to me. A lot of it, you know, there are kind of matey tweets about Piers Morgan supporting Arsenal, an attempt to sound a more colloquial voice. This maximum wage thing, I'm not sure he purposely floated that or whether that was just something John Humphreys asked him. But if you're going to propose something as drastic as that, it takes years of work. You need groundwork. You need think tanks on the case. You've really got to prepare the ground, you know, otherwise people will just monster you. So I'm not impressed so far, I have to say.
Anne, I suspect they would draw the analogy with Trump and they would say a lot of his policies seemed kind of absurd and not well worked out, and they didn't come with the backing of the kind of establishment, and they hadn't done the numbers, and there weren't any specifics about it, and yet somehow he made a lot of noise and he appeared to be on the side of ordinary people. That's what they're trying to do, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I suppose that is the ambition. But obviously, you know, he's doing it from the position as leader of the Labour Party, about which those of us who think about politics, you know, have clear ideas. It has a clear sort of brand identity. He's not coming out of the blue. He's not coming as a television star, which is essentially what Trump was elected as, you know, reality TV. I mean, maybe Corbyn should have had an apprenticeship in reality TV. It might have kind of honed his skills a bit.
But, an idea. And
you know, when you just to pick up on John's point about the lack of development of these ideas, I mean, one, you know, we were told it was going to be some kind of, maybe some kind of UKIP light approach to border control, but it doesn't sound like that at all. It sounds more as if he's thinking about some kind of EU accord on free movement of labour. You know, not a bad idea, last year maybe. And then, you know, the idea of a wage cap, I mean, no one's yet managed to make that work, however desirable it is, not in a free democratic society anyway. So, I wait to be convinced.
He's also not the only player on the kind of populist pitch either, is he, Max? I mean, as we discussed, Theresa May is very much trying to show that she wants to sort of stand up to vested interests
I think there's also just a fundamental... There's a sort of theory and practice to this, isn't there? So in theory, is there space in the British kind of political landscape for left populism? Yes, absolutely. I think that, as we discussed, you know, Theresa May has grasped a sort of realisation that the public are not particularly content with sort of free market status quo. Whether or not her party agrees with her on that is a separate question, but there's certainly space and scope for a sort of populist left-wing kind of firebrand approach to this and an approach to economic justice. But that the practice side of this is missing, because that isn't Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is not... The bit of the Labour movement that Jeremy Corbyn represents is not the sort of left populist bit of the Labour movement. It's the liberal Islingtonian populist bit of the Labour movement. This is a man who last year turned up at the Kebab Awards and gave a speech about how devastating it was there weren't enough vegetarian options. He genuinely does not...
I do sympathise him with him.
Well, I'm sure, but he's not configured to play the Trump game in terms of appealing at an emotional level. And the things that he's interested in talking about... You know, this morning he's supposed to be talking about sort of... the big identity issues, which are really having an effect in Labour's heartlands, I'm sure John will be able to tell you more about, but around identity, around immigration, around the extent to which people feel like they're part of a shared and collective endeavour. And instead of talking about that, because he doesn't want to talk about that, because he doesn't believe in any of that, he then kind of rambles off on some very vague notions around maximum wage, which is... others have said, I'm not sure even deliberately did it, aside from as a way of not talking about the issue, that actually his backbenchers would be desperately, desperately hoping that he finds a way of emotionally tuning in with, because this is a huge issue. Where I come from in Cumbria, there's a by-election coming up. This is a huge issue for people. Questions of identity are really important at the moment, and Jeremy Corbyn doesn't have any sort of popular appeal on that.
That's right, is it? John, do you think the Copeland by-election will be a very interesting test? There are a number of key tests coming up this year that we'll see whether Labour is able to sort of tap into this new post-Brexit mood.
It's a very interesting part of the world, West Cumbria. It's where my maternal grandparents are from. And it's people miss this because of the Lake District. It's the absolute epitome, really, of 95% white working class, still industrial because of the Sellafield plant sort of community, in which sort of liberal pieties about nuclear power, Jeremy Corbyn, I think, has got a long track record of post-nuclear power, really play terribly badly. It's not post-industrial. It's not UKIP land in the way that Stoke-on-Trent is, in the sense that tens of thousands of people are still in work. There's a large trade union presence, but it did vote to remain. And if you look at the electoral arithmetic, clearly, I mean, if what, 12 or 1300 Labour voters decide to vote UKIP, then the Tories, because it's a Tory Labour marginal, are in with a shout. And in that sense, if it returned a Tory MP, it would look like a validation, whether fairly or not, unfairly in my opinion, of Theresa May's tilt into this new sort of mainstream populism. So there's a hell of a lot at stake there, and it's going to be a fascinating contest. I'm going to go there very soon, I think. I mean, it really cries out for reporting and immersing yourself.
I don't think there'll be any shortage of reporters heading up.
No, it'll be crawling with them.
It will. And it's interesting, this new landscape, isn't it? It does feel a bit, whether Brexit was just an expression of things that have been simmering for a long time, but it does feel as if it sort of shifted the political landscape a bit, doesn't it?
It hasn't shifted the political landscape a bit, it seems to me. It's like a kind of, sorry to use such a cliche, but it is a real kind of sort of tectonic plate moment. And I almost wonder about, you know, thinking about 2017 and what's ahead. And in the same way that kind of quite a big earthquake like Brexit, which I reckon is quite a big earthquake, can produce an even bigger and more devastating tsunami aftermath. And you kind of feel that might be what 2017 is about. I don't think we're going to see suddenly a complete realignment of politics, but it just seems to me there are kind of different poles now, and the conditions are prepared for people to kind of rethink where they are and why they are. The whole post-war idea of politics has been shattered.
Yeah.
And that feels right in the Tory party, doesn't it, Max, too? It's sort of hearing from, you know, from the Nicky Morgans or the Anna Soubrys at one end, or, you know, from the sort of liberated Brexiters at the other. I mean, the sort of pieces have been shaken up a bit, haven't they, in a way that they haven't been for a long time?
Very much so. And kind of new alliances are formed, new enemies are made. I mean, I've been involved in the Conservative Party for, you know, my entire adult life, for my sins. And I've heard that Thatcherism's dead many times and, you know, keeps raising itself from the grave. So, I mean, I wouldn't write it off just yet. But I think what certainly happened, what's very interesting, is that you have some of the traditional allegiances breaking down. There is a section of the Conservative Party, Anna Soubry, Nicola Morgan maybe sort of embody it, which will not let go of the idea that more and more embrace of liberal values on both the economic and the social front is the way forward for the Conservative Party. There's also a section of the Conservative Party who, let's be frank, you know, are very interested in economic freedom and also very interested in hanging and flogging. And then in the middle, you have an emerging kind of solid idea of sort of Macmillanite state-backed conservatism having a real future in a Brexit Britain that is sort of converging around Theresa May. I think that the challenge for her and for the people around her and the people who support and agree with that emerging and nascent movement is to establish some momentum on that. And that's where your question at the start about, well, where's the policy in this comes into play? Because actually, we need to start putting real flags in the ground around it if we're going to win in places like Copeland. Because it's not enough, as John's saying, to simply give the speech. We need something to filter down. And I think that there'll be, you know, we've got a budget to come in the spring. And I think that there will be a lot of disappointment if in that budget we don't see coming to flower some of the seeds that were planted in Theresa May's speech when she first became Prime Minister, and indeed in the speech that she's just given 6 months in.
Interesting. And John, smaller parties can sometimes, you know, thrive or you know, come and go in times when things are in flux like this. UKIP is going to be very interesting, isn't it, in the next year? And also the Liberal Democrats and the extent to which they can kind of harness and sort of give voice to the frustration of people who would have loved us to vote a different way last year.
Yeah. I mean, as Anne said, the idea of some sort of grand, all-encompassing realignment, I think that's not going to happen for the foreseeable future. But nonetheless, you get the sense that everything is very fragile. The model of politics that we had for the whole of the second half of the 20th century across Europe and Britain, whereby everything is about a contest between the centre-right and the centre-left, and there are two forces, clearly that's in a very sort of delicate, borderline sort of broken condition. And UKIP never go away, do they? I mean, you know, comment writers, every sort of 6 months they write a piece that says, oh, peak UKIP, now they've gone away. And they always seem to come back. And I think they're going to have a real gift, which I think a lot of us overlook, actually. When you go to places that voted Leave and you talk to them, as I had did before Christmas in Sleaford, about how they feel about where things are, they say, why haven't we left the European Union already? Come on, where is it? We're just going to get stitched up here. They feel there's about to be some big betrayal. Now, that's inevitable because it's going to take us a long time to negotiate our way out. And within that delay, which no one can do anything about, completely cynically and opportunistically, Paul Nuttall and UKIP and Aaron Banks, who was meant to be launching his new English movement in the new year, I don't know what's happened to that, he will be around as well. I think 48-52 politics will sort of bubble away, and in the right sort of places will reveal itself, as it did in Richmond. And therefore, particularly given the shift the Labour Party seems to have sort of half made this morning, I think the Lib Dem revival, modestly, will reveal itself from time to time. I think they're going to do better. I don't want to make predictions, but I think they'll be back in double figures in the polls reasonably quickly.
Interesting. All right. Now, before you all go, John's just said he doesn't want to make predictions, but we were just going to throw three very quick questions at you for 2017. Will there be a general election this year, Anne?
I think not.
Max?
I don't think so, no.
John?
No, absolutely not. Theresa May's far too clever for that.
So that's very clear. Will the three Brexit ministers, Liam Fox, Boris Johnson, David Davis, all be in place come December, Anne?
Oh, that's much harder, isn't it? And I keep thinking, but you know, why don't they just cut Liam Fox adrift now?
Sharp intake of breath. By December?
Well, but you know, he's very close to May, and May is very loyal to her associates. So I guess he's going to be there briefing unconstructively and damagingly for the foreseeable future.
Max, your jaw dropped then.
Well, I didn't.
Are they all still going to be in place by December?
The three of them to think that Liam was the one who spends his time damaging briefly, badly. And I mean, I don't know if they'll all be in place or not. I mean, David Davis has a habit of resigning with great theatre, so who knows?
Perhaps we should have said which is going to be the first to go. John, what do you think?
Please don't move Liam Fox. I'd have nothing to tweet about.
And lastly, will Jeremy Corbyn, the new populist Jeremy Corbyn, still be Labour leader by the end of 2017? Anne, what do you think?
This is the one prediction that the FT got right in for the start of 2016. Yes, and I think so. I think he'll be there at the end of the year.
Max?
Yes, I think he will do, and I think he will also be there. And I think that more interestingly than that, I think that his long-term future depends very much on what happens in Unite's election this year.
Interesting. John, will Jeremy still be in place by the end of the year, do you think?
I'll close by sounding rather po-faced. It's not even the issue. The Labour Party is in a deep historic crisis. It's been ongoing now for 6 or 7 years. Every 6 months, whether it's Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband or Jeremy Corbyn, it tries to find some way of inserting itself into the 21st century. It is failing. There's no other option, and that's an indication of how much it's failing. So he'll be there, but I don't think it's going to get much better. Things can only get worse, to paraphrase Tony Blair.
Thanks for that cheering New Year message, John. There you go. We'll see how it all pans out, and you can follow it all at theguardian.com/politics. And we should just say that I'm pretty sure John Harris meant to say the Copeland constituency voted for Leave there. In the whole of British parliamentary history, there have only been 455 female MPs. To put that in neat perspective, there are 455 male MPs currently sitting in the House of Commons. It's a record that means Britain is 48th in the international rankings when it comes to the representation of women in Parliament. And with boundary changes and a reduction in the total number of MPs in the offing, it could well slide further. Well, joining me now is Maria Miller, the Conservative MP who's chair of the Women and Equalities Committee, which has published a report this week with proposals on how to tackle the issue. Why do you think, Maria, this is not something, the representation of women in Parliament is not something that will just happen over time by itself? You know, women are playing an increasingly, you know, fair role in other walks of life. Why is this not happening in Parliament?
Well, I think we've seen in many other different sorts of jobs and careers that women take up, that there's been really a necessity to put in place particular measures to try and support more women, and businesses do this on a regular basis, whether it's the initiative that Lord Davis put in place to increase the number of women on boards. You know, you need to focus on an issue, and what this report is doing is saying the political parties need to focus on the issue of getting more women into Parliament, because it won't just happen by osmosis.
And if they don't focus sufficiently on it, you think government should legislate to make change?
Yes, at the next general election, we could see more than 20 women who are currently sitting as MPs lose their seats because of boundary changes. And if parties don't grasp that, and also the over-dependence on one particular party to supply many of those women MPs...
That's the Labour Party, right, which has had all women shortlists and so on?
That's the Labour Party, who have 44% of their MPs are female in this parliament. And if that were to change at the next parliament, if we're to see more than 20 women seats disappear, we could be seeing parliament going backwards at a time where, you know, we've got a second ever female prime minister, and women are, as you rightly say, taking up so many important and prominent positions in other walks of life.
And is there something particular about the culture at Westminster, at Parliament, that makes women not want to take it on as a job, do you think?
No, I think that there are two issues at play here. One is still too many communities don't have female community leaders, and therefore women don't always think of becoming an elected representative as something that's open to them. That's still something relatively unusual in many areas of the country. And I think secondly, we have focused, I think, too much on childcare and working hours, and not enough on the dissuading effect of things like harassment, online abuse particularly, and also latterly the violence against female members of parliament, which is now not just something we see abroad, it's something we see at home as well, with the tragic murder of Joe Cox. And we need to tackle those issues if we're really to also make sure that women are seeing this as a positive choice for them to make as a way of supporting their own community.
And Theresa May worked hard, didn't she, in previous years to try and get more women elected as Conservative MPs. Is this an issue you would like to see her take on?
Well, I think she does already. I mean, she set up Women to Win, which is a very effective way that the Conservative Party helps to mentor and support more women coming into Parliament, and other parties have similar organisations. I know that Theresa May continues to be very mindful of the need for us to have more women in Parliament. This isn't a problem for one particular party, though. It's across the board. And as we have the boundary changes coming up with more than 20 women affected by it, I think what I'd like to see as a result of the evidence we've taken is the sort of the clear support from party leaders for more women to go alongside a clear strategy for each party to take. I don't doubt at all the genuine support from party leaders for more women in Parliament, but we're not seeing that at the moment converting into hard, fast strategies
that
we can measure and evaluate.
And if there aren't more detailed and sort of more focused strategies on this, it could be many, many years, could it, before we can see a 50-50 Parliament?
Yes, and that's why the key recommendation in our report is that if there isn't more progress at the next election, that 45%, that we should put a piece of legislation in place which says that 45% of candidates after that should be women. 45% because we felt that saying 50% or a minimum of 45% candidates, because we felt that 50% of candidates being female might lead us to a situation where actually parties find it quite difficult to control it exactly. So we're saying a minimum of 45% candidates being female. And under the UN Sustainable Goals, which the government signed up to under David Cameron, there's a requirement for very specific targets there around increased female participation in Parliament as well. And that's why we put in place the suggestion that the government might want to adopt a goal of 45% female MPs by 2030.
Maria Miller, thanks very much. And if you like this podcast, why not try The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast? This week, Ian Sample discusses the ethics of genetics and why bioengineering poses challenges for politics and wider society. To listen, just go to theguardian.com/podcast or find us on Acast, iTunes and other great podcast apps. Now, finally this week, new elections to the Northern Ireland Assembly appear to be inevitable following the resignation of Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness as Deputy First Minister. Well, joining me on the line now is The Guardian's Ireland correspondent, Henry MacDonald. So, Henry, we ended the year over here in Westminster with a lot of speculation about snap elections and could we see one? It sounds like you're going to get one over there.
I think it's pretty inevitable we're going to get an election. The countdown to that will begin on Monday next when the regional parliament, the devolved assembly, comes back after the Christmas recess. Given Martin McGuinness's resignation, given the rules of devolution, the very unique rules in Northern Ireland where, you know, both communities have to be represented as in the two top positions, First and Deputy First Minister, the government, the regional government, cannot continue as it is now, and that the only alternative then is to have fresh elections.
And remind us how we got here. It started with what sounds like a fairly innocuous green energy scheme.
Yes, burning wood pellets. Exactly. At the core of the crisis was a major miscalculation. The DUP sponsored, the Democratic Unionist Party sponsored this scheme. They championed it for non-domestic users, like, for example, farmers, the big farming community, where you have a boiler and you were compensated from if you got involved in the scheme. And it turned out that for every £1 you spent on the scheme to heat your farm, for example, you were given £1.60 back by Stormont, which
sounds great.
Yeah, it's absolutely quids in. And what this meant then is a huge bill to the taxpayer, which it is now estimated today, this morning, could run to £500 million over a 10-year period. So a big hole in the finances. And the DUP stuck very hard and loyal to the scheme right up until the last. Ministers refused to agree to a public inquiry initially, and then the big demand was that the First Minister, Arlene Foster, should stand down while the inquiry took place, only temporarily. No one was asking for her to resign completely. When she refused to do that, under pressure principally from the opposition parties, not from Sinn Féin, she continued to refuse. They tried to get to get a vote of no confidence in her at Christmas, just before Christmas. That failed. It did not get the support of Sinn Féin. I think there was probably internal pressure within Sinn Féin to take a harder stance on their DUP partners in government. And we are where we are now. Martin McGuinness has resigned.
Mm. And there's quite a lot of bad blood, isn't there? I mean, does this to what extent does this jeopardise the power-sharing agreement, which, as you say, requires both these parties to go back into government in some form or another?
It does. I mean, it depends really on the mathematics, what happens after the contest, which will take place within about 6 to 7 weeks' time. An election, really, that none of the parties want, because we had an election 6 months ago, just in May there, and I think the public aren't too keen on an election either, but there you go. Turnout will be vital. I think that it's going to be very hard to piece together the broken power-sharing coalition. It'll be long negotiations into the night, I would imagine, as is the norm in Northern Ireland politics. It's going to be quite difficult. It'll be fascinating to see how the two big parties do. Will they both take hits? Will their seat numbers chip away as a result of public disillusionment over the way this is being handled?
All right, Henry, we look forward to hearing more from you about what happens next. Thanks ever so much. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Henry McDonald, Maria Miller, Max Wind-Cowie, John Harris and Anne Perkins. And finally, we have a small favour to ask. More people are reading and listening to The Guardian than ever before, but far fewer are paying for it, and advertising revenues across the media are falling fast. So you can see why we need to ask for your help. The Guardian's independent, investigative journalism takes a lot of time, money and hard work to produce. To help fund our journalism, go to gu.com/give. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/Guardian.